Welcome to episode 91 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Breakroom. I'm your host, Brad Treffler. Before I get to this week's episode, another reminder, we have the live Planning Period Podcast meetup happening at ISTE, Philadelphia, June 23rd, 6 p.m. Pat's King of Steaks. We'll be going from there to Geno's. I'll be joined with a lot of other education podcasters. Chris Nessie, Stacey Lindis, AJ Bianco. I've heard that Casey Bell might be there, maybe Matt Miller. All kinds of awesome people are going to be out at Pat's King of Steaks on June 23rd at 6 p.m. in Philadelphia. So if you're going to ISTE, join me there. This week on the show, I am joined by Thaddeus Barassa, an instructional support teacher and EdTech mentor out of Manitoba, Canada. As a coach, he is focused on increasing pedagogical work with or without technology. Thaddeus is the third of my podcasting blind dates I have done for this show, so I went in knowing very little and learned a lot about him through this interview. Thaddeus and I talk about technology coaching versus instructional coaching, the value of collaboration with peers, how testing is different in different areas, the need to decide what we value in education, the need to move that conversation outside our building to all stakeholders, why teachers should share their vulnerabilities, and how important it is for teachers to get to know students as people. So, sit back and enjoy episode 91 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Thaddeus Barassa. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Treffler, and this morning we are continuing two things. First of all, my unnecessarily early podcast interviews, which, you know, really totally on me because I make those time slots available for people. And also our third in a series of the podcasting blind dates. And today I am joined by Thaddeus Barassa. I didn't even ask how to say your name before we started. I had it in my notes to ask how to say your name and I totally forgot. But did I get it right? Thaddeus Barassa?
You got it right. Yeah, if it's a little – Thaddeus is a bit of a different name. It's got a bit of, I think, a Greek origin, and Barassa is French, and I think you even rolled the R a little bit. So Thaddeus Barassa, you got it. You got it perfect, nice. Brad.
I was pretty confident on Thaddeus. The Barassa I wasn't positive about. So.
Yeah. No, you got it.
Well, Thaddeus, first of all, thank you for joining me on the show. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And could you, for myself and my audience, give me a little intro to who you are?
Yeah, so I'm coming out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and I am an instructional support teacher, so sort of like an educational coach. I have the pleasure of working with teachers and their students across grades 5 through 12 in the Louis Riel School Division, which is a school division with approximately around just over 40 schools, about 15,000 kids. And I'm also an ed tech mentor. There's an ed tech mentorship program. So I'm an instructional support coach and also an ed tech mentor. I have recently left the classroom, so there are new roles for me. Before that, I was teaching grades 4 through 11 at several different schools. And so I'm, you know, it's very exciting new roles. And, you know, I've really been enjoying myself this year.
Nice. So how does the instructional, the coach, the ed tech mentor differ from the instructional support teacher role? How are those two things different?
Yeah, good question. You know, I feel there's a lot of natural overlap, a lot of natural connections, and a lot of what I'm trying to do as an instructional support coach, trying new stuff, making things safe enough to try, working on personalized learning goals, working on tier one pedagogy and support. I think a lot of overlap. When I do my ed tech mentorship piece, there's just really a lot of focus on making sure we can integrate technology. Whereas an instructional support coach, we may not take that route. It may be literacy, numeracy, and we haven't even thought about integrating technology, which is okay. When I'm doing the ed tech support piece, we're trying to get some clicks in there, but we're not just going to do technology for the sake of having technology. We're going to ensure that it's redefining the teaching and learning experience, and it's augmenting that space. So, you know, the technology piece is a must within that role and not so much when I'm just an instructional support coach.
What is the, I'm trying to understand the reasoning behind the distinction. Is that something that like your board puts in place? Is there a funding reason that those things are separated, or is it
that it's a new position and evolving? What is that? Why is it set up that way? Because it's a unique setup for that position.
Yeah. And you know what? I think the instructional support teacher that I am primarily is my role is this through the school division. And it was the job that I applied for. And it's all encompassing. It's doing professional development. It's doing one-on-one personalized professional learning, which is a model that we use in Louis Riel School Division to support teachers with their personalized learning goals. Over the course of the year, I'm then a collaborative learning partner. There's the IT department that has funded ed tech mentorship programs, and they're giving, for example, some of the groups teachers are getting devices like Surface Go's or Surface Pro's, and they're really wanting to focus on technology. So that's some budget money has been pulled out of that program, that department, and really trying to help teachers integrate some technology, and for us to help support them as a coach and to find places where we can co-teach and co-learn with them, but to make the technology safe enough to try and to remove the barrier of thinking we need to be the experts before we try it. And so I think it is a little bit of that it's directly coming out of the IT department and they're focusing just on technology, but with the spin that the pedagogy and research and, you know, looking at what we know is best for kids and how can technology support that, where my main position, my main role as an instructional support teacher, there is no pressure for me to use technology, to integrate technology, or to even talk about technology. I often will look at, start with the goals, the refined goals, and then think about how can we use technology to strengthen what kids are going to be doing or increase engagement. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of stuff I'm doing with teachers that I don't have technology integrated in it. And for a lot of times, I'm okay with that. It doesn't, you know, there's a time and a place. And as a Microsoft innovative expert, I'm all for technology integration. But, you know, we don't always need to. And I feel like there's times that I'm okay with that. So I think it's just coming from the departments, the funding, and their goals, what their goals are. One is strictly, let's get teachers using technology, let's get kids using technology, let's think how it can redefine the space. And the other one is, let's just do some really good learning together. And it doesn't need to include technology.
It's interesting. Do you see, you know, I think you said you're fairly new to this. Do you see this combined role evolving or changing over time now that you've done it a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I feel like the jobs could definitely merge. Like, I feel like there's a need for a full-time technology coach. Some school divisions in Winnipeg have that. They'll have a literacy coach. They'll have a numeracy coach. They'll have a technology integration specialist. I just came back from a conference in Atlanta, Ed Element's Personalized Learning Summit, and they had a lot of instructional coaches that were specific to, you know, areas within teaching and learning, numeracy, literacy, technology. In my school division, my primary focus is an itinerant traveling teacher or support teacher, and I kind of do everything. I'm on a team, there's eight of us, and often we will, you know, have consultations with schools and with individuals, and we'll look at our individual skills and our strengths and figure out who's going to be the best match for the school or for the person to support that. But there's still a lot of not pressure, but there's the onus on me that I should be well-versed in everything. And I should be able to support a teacher regardless if they're grade 11 chemistry or they're grade 5 wanting to introduce, you know, project-based learning or inquiry learning models. So I could see the jobs being combined. I could see myself simply doing a full-time ed tech mentorship piece. We're a Microsoft division, and we've been using a lot of their inclusive learning tools, a lot of Immersive Reader and Dictate and Translator, a lot of OneNote integration, a lot of Skype, a lot of Flipgrid, a lot of different programs and tools that teachers are asking for more. And I'm very busy with that job. So, you know, whether or not the two merge, and again, our I don't know if you've read the political climate that's going on in Manitoba, but we're moving towards amalgamation, which will be possibly similar to what has happened in Nova Scotia. So, you know, the Louis Riel School Division could very soon down the road become the Winnipeg Division. And if we become one division, you know, I don't even know where I will be at that point. So this is something that is in the back of my mind as we talk.
So when you, I don't know that, that's news to me. So when you talk about the amalgamation, you said, so that's basically taking the smaller divisions or districts and combining them into one larger one?
You bet. You know, and I don't know, you're in Ontario, correct, Brad?
No, I'm in Orlando, and our,
okay,
our district is 19 high schools, 30 something middle schools, and 50 elementary schools. So we are definitely more like what you might become as opposed to what you are. So that's why I'm interested.
Yeah. And you know what, there's a, like in Calgary, for example, Calgary is, you know, we're about a third of the size of Calgary and they have one division. It's for a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it's just for, we're in the midst of an educational review. Now there hasn't been a review in the last 50 years. So I think that's a good thing. The other motivations behind it, I won't get into it, but they're looking at making it into one school division. So taking all these different, you know, call them districts, all these different districts and pushing them and just having one giant school division that will serve all students and teachers and families and stakeholders across the entire city of Winnipeg. So that's going to be a big change. And there's going to be some, you know, growing ache pains through that process. And who knows what's going to happen with my position even, because there's versions of me in other school divisions and districts, but, they're different depending on the division you're in. You could just be a literacy coach, in a division. So it'll be interesting what happens when that, you know, how will the culture and climate change and how will we, look at coaches, whether you call it an itinerant traveling teacher or instructional support coach, whether you call it a teaching consultant, it all comes down to, you know, spending a lot of time teaching and learning with adults. I don't know what will happen because I know there's a need for them, but we'll see. It'll be interesting. For right now, I'm safe and I'm very happy where I'm at. So
nice. Very cool. Yeah. It's kind of funny. I'm thinking, you know, at your role as an instructional coach, whether it's through instructional or the technology side, is very much creating change. And I know as a coach, one of the biggest problems we face as a coach is the fear of change and getting teachers over that fear of change. And now there's this massive change looming on the horizon for you that would mean a possible job loss or job change. So it's almost ironic that that future change could be causing so many issues for you when you have to deal with that fear of change every day and what you do, right?
It, you know what, it is a bit scary, but at the end of the day, I try to do, you know, the best I can to focus my energy on what I do have control over. And I have no control over our divisions getting amalgamated. I do have control of, you know, getting up and having a good day and realizing that I'm in a very privileged space and that I'm one of, you know, eight teachers that gets to travel across the division and gets to see all these pockets of brilliance and gets to work with lots of different teachers. You know, I'm working with teachers grades 5 through 12. And so I think it's, I don't know of any other role that lends itself to learning and seeing so much. Cause I always say I'm an expert at nothing. I just love learning and I love working with teachers. I love collaborating. I love connecting. I love working on personalized learning goals with teachers. And I always remind myself of how blessed I am. And it's a very unique job and it's a very cool job.
That lends itself nicely to where I wanted to head next, which is, what is your favorite part about your job? What is the best part about what you do?
Probably my favorite part is just collaborating. You know, when I was in the classroom, what often got in the way of those awesome planning sessions was time. And so you'd go to your administrator and you'd beg for a half day where you could get together with your teaching partner across the hall or a couple other teachers in your building or maybe teachers at other schools, and you could get together and in a 2.5 hours in the morning you created some really magical stuff. Because I always firmly believe that, you know, we're better together, and that the more people you can get in a room around a common goal, and you know, you establish your learning targets, you refine your goals, and then you just bounce ideas off and you and some really beautiful stuff comes out of that. But I never really got that as much as I wanted as a classroom teacher. And time does get in the way. You know, for myself, when I was, you know, teaching grade 5, 6, 7, 8, you have like a half an hour prep. You know, by the time you go to the bathroom, you do your photocopying, you answer a few emails, you haven't really gotten time to collaborate. You might have a double prep and then you've got an hour and then maybe a few days a week you can get together. But I never was really able to connect with teachers as much as I wanted to and be able to work with them and to plan and to create some really cool stuff with kids. So now in my job, I get time. And I there's days that I'm in 3 or 4 different schools that I get to intentionally plan and talk about learning goals and talk about kids and talk about, you know, cool stuff that we want to try together. And that's been beautiful. I think that's something that I've enjoyed and helping refine goals for teachers. You know, we use the language boulder, pebble, sand goals. So a teacher might come in with a giant boulder goal, which is okay. And once we refine it down to that granular level and we're at that sand goal and we really start moving into action and we're co-teaching together and co-planning and co-sharing, that gets really exciting. You know, I really love when teachers have reached their goals and are feeling good and have tried something new and that I know that I've been a very small part of that permanent change in learning. So that through that gradual release of responsibility, when I'm not with them anymore, you know, and they're on their own, going back to that, you know, that quote, I'm not giving them a fish. I've taught them to fish. They've taught themselves to fish and together they have a new skill or a new tool that they can use and they get excited. And I think that's exciting. You know, I feed off of other people's energy. So it's the co-planning, co-sharing, co-reflecting, co-teaching, all these pieces that we use in this personalized professional learning model that we use in the division, which is exciting and getting to work with so many people. Like that's amazing. Like I'm between ed tech mentor and instructional support coach. I'm probably working with, you know, right now 30 teachers. And I take lessons from each one of them and I learn from each one of them. And I think that's a really, again, a privileged space to be in for learning and for just seeing a lot of really cool stuff in the classrooms.
Yeah, I definitely, I think when you're a coach or an instructional support, if your favorite part of the day is supporting teachers and working with teachers, then you're probably in the right space. I think that's probably lending itself well to your passion. So that works out. That works out really well. I mentioned before the show that I've had the best and the worst week ever. And so I want to ask you a question before to see if it lends itself to where I think you might go with this. But I just asked you what your favorite part is. What's your least favorite part of your job?
I miss kids. You know, I'm everyone's favorite uncle, so to speak, when I come into the classroom and, hey, it's Mr. B. And you know, that's always a nice piece to be a part of. But at the same time, I'm not spread thin, but I'm in so many buildings, and I'm in and out and I'm in and out and I miss the relationships, with kids, on a deep, intimate level. I miss the connections with adults, being a part of one school community. So I think, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. I get to see, you know, be in 12 different schools and I get to meet with tons of different teachers. And some days I'm in 4 schools and I get to see so much of the landscape and all these little pockets of brilliance spread across our division, which is so amazing. And I go home and my brain is just filled with, you know, new ideas I've taken and my phone's filled with new pictures that I've taken off of bulletin boards and jot notes that I've taken. But I do miss being a part of one school community. I do miss having my 28 kids for the year, and really getting to know them, as people and really, you know, seeing that growth. You don't experience that as much as a coach. So I can see why sometimes people in my position after 2 or 3 years want to take everything that they've learned and want to go back to the classroom and they want to apply it and they want to try it with their kids. So I think that's probably the thing that's been the hardest for me is, you know, when people ask, I tell them a whole bunch of great stuff. And then they often say, do you miss kids? And I say, yeah, I miss kids. You know, I'm around kids a lot, but it's a lot different when you come in for an hour You know, even some classrooms, oh, we were co-planning and co-teaching for 2 days a week, each for an hour. That was great, 8 weeks in a row. But I really, it's a drop in the bucket of how much time I get to spend with kids and being with kids. And I might start to get to know them by name and get to know the kids a little bit, but it's, you know, that relationship piece is still very surface level. So I think that's definitely something that I do miss.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I'm lucky in my role that I also run our student tech support center at our school. So I actually do have roughly 25 students attached to me, you know, two or three a period over seven periods. So it's nice to have that, you know, to be able to have some relationships built up with those students. I've always said I have a nice hybrid role where I get to have a little bit of both of the coaching and the teaching still, which I really thoroughly enjoy. So it's been nice to have that. So I get completely that missing component. That was the deal when I left the classroom, was I will do this, but only if I get to also run student tech, because I still want students. I still want to be able to work with kids and work on those things, which I think gives me an advantage in the instructional coaching side and the technology coaching, because I'm actually using technology with students in classrooms every day, but also supporting teachers with the use of technology every day. So I feel like that's always given me an advantage and an edge in coaching.
Yeah, that sounds like a really, you know, a happy medium. And you know, even I, you know, I am spending time with kids, and I am, when I'm co-teaching or I'm teaching, and you know, the teacher that I'm working with might be observing, I'm in there with kids, and then, you know, we're doing some stuff together, and we're trying out new technology, and we're rolling out some cool lessons together, and I might see them several weeks in a row. But just, you know, it's different than being with kids all day, or being with kids from September to June, and you can look back and say, you know, like, wow, like, what growth, whether it was through reading or through, you know, social, emotionally, where was that kid in September? Where is that kid in June? And just really getting to know kids on that, you know, that deep, intimate level, and really getting to know them as people, that is very hard to accomplish through the job that I'm in right now. So it sounds like you've got a nice gig, Brad.
Yeah, for now, till I change it all up and make something different.
There you go. And that's always exciting too.
Yeah. I was wondering if you might say that the worst part of your job is the administrative components of the job, because I think sometimes that's the worst part for me, is the stuff you don't want to do, the other duties as assigned, some of that kind of stuff, and just the extra stuff that gets in the way. I mentioned on the podcast last week that testing has created a nightmare scenario for my school. Technical issues on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of testing, each of those days caused us to rewrite our modified testing schedule. And every time we rewrote the modified testing schedule, I had to rewrite my laptop collection schedule. We're a one-to-one school and have 2,700 students who all have laptops. And our last day of school, by the time this airs, our last day of school will have been 2 days ago. So from the time we're talking, I have 3 days of school left for the year. And I have to collect 2,700 laptops in more or less 4 days. And with Memorial Day, our students will probably not be coming to school on Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, or at least very few of them will. So it's created this nightmare scenario that has been stressing me out since Monday, knowing that this, you know, best laid plans I spent a week building has been completely trashed and rewritten and built and rewritten and built again. And then yesterday happened, and in one day, we collected over 1,500 laptops, and it was the most insane day of my life. And it was one of those days where it was so busy that you didn't really even notice that it was busy, if that makes any sense. I was so swamped that when we were so constantly busy, it was just getting the work done. And it was my students supporting and other adults supporting, and just a crew of people made this possible. And so when I ran the numbers at the end of the day and was like, wait, we collected how many? This is now my fourth year of collecting laptops. We've never collected more than 1,000 in a day, and we collected 1,500 yesterday, which I'm like, even thinking about it now, I'm like exhausted again. So it's been a very interesting week for me.
Yeah, it sounds very busy. I'm trying to think of those that numbers, the sheer astronomical number, 1,500 in a day just seems just crazy. And you got me also thinking about, you know, testing. I had said that I had come back from a conference in Atlanta, and that was one of the things that I kept talking to teachers and administrators about, was the pressures of testing and even, you know, early on, some testing in kindergarten and grade one and two, and how we don't really have those pressures as much. You know, we have our provincial exams, but just not to the same extent as you seem to have in the States. And, you know, I almost felt guilty sharing some of the, you know, the day to days and what the ends of our years look like as kids, you know, roll out their exams, but just not the same pressures as having those standardized tests and just having that. And I think that must be a lot of pressure on teachers and on kids too. So it's a bit of a high stress time too, I would gather.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, the thing, I think I tweeted this out, but the thing people don't realize about the high stress, well, there's lots of things they don't realize about the high stress testing, but one of them is, you know, these kids have been prepping for these tests and they know how important they are. You know, these tests we're doing right now, this last round of them, they're the common final exams, and they're worth 20% of the student's grade for the year. So they're a big deal. You know, they're a big, big deal. And when you have technology issues on the day the kid was prepped to take their U.S. history common final exam, and now it's not today, it's Wednesday or whatever, that really messes with kids. You know, that's they're already psyching themselves out and prep for this high stress thing, and then the high stress target moves at the last minute, and it just adds even more stress and more change to them. And it's a struggle, man. And you know, I mentioned testing schedules. Some of these kids, the only routine they have is school, and now we're changing that up because they're not going to all seven periods. They're only going to second, fourth, and sixth today, and they're there for 2 hours each. And you know, you just change everything on kids and then expect them to perform and then think those tests are somehow the proof that they learned something all year.
Yeah. And you know, I know tests, you know, big stakes, high stakes exams are always going to be a part of life, whether it's formally, you know, on paper or just, you know, in the job interviews and different things and hurdles that you have to jump over in life. But I do get a bit leery about the, you know, the 20 or 30% exam that is supposed to represent your understanding and your learning, that one time and space that the kid writes it, you know, what's going on in their lives. You know, what, like you said, this stressful target, it keeps moving. And, you know, is that causing anxiety and what's getting in the way? And I just, you know, I don't love it, but I know it's as much as we're trying to change, you know, what do we really value in education, and you know, what are the most important skills that kids are learning? And I think we're starting to be at a bit of a pendulum shift here, and we're starting to think about what we should value and how some of our you know, our core beliefs are changing. But at the university levels, it's still giant big exams, and it's still rote memorization of facts, and it's the sit in an exam room in that one time and space and fill out a big booklet that then represents, you know, your all encompassing knowledge in that one time and space. So, you know, I don't know where it's going in the future, but I'm hoping that we can get away from that a little bit, because I don't feel like it's the best way to go about finding the at the heart, what does a kid really know? But you know, I don't have any other suggestions at the moment. So I think I'm just complaining. But I think there's having some conversations, you know, as educators, talk about why are we still doing it this way? You know, I have my questions of is there a better way to do it? And I think if you got a bunch of really smart adults together and just talk through it, I think, and I know there's other, you know, places that have gotten rid of the grades, so to speak, and, you know, having kids being reduced to a percentage. You know, there's a lot of research, you know, whether you talk about Alfie Cohen, can we go gradeless? You know, there's a lot of philosophies out there, but, you know, it'll be interesting if we were having this conversation in 10 years from now. Are we still handing out the exam booklets? Are we still, you know, doing the stresses of standardized testing, and how much are they weighted, and maybe have we found some new tools and some new practices for kids? Because I do feel like we can do better, but for now it's just a part of the game, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it is. You know, let's move into some of the heart of my episode. You know, we've been chatting for 30 minutes talking about work and talking about coaching and all of those things. So let's move in, because you're starting to touch on some of the issues in education, and that lends itself perfectly into my first question for all my guests. And my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I had promised myself I wasn't going to listen to any of your other podcasts, so I wouldn't have any reference or I wouldn't have any time to be able to prepare myself. So you're going to throw the zinger at me. What is the biggest obstacle in education today? I think the biggest obstacle right now is shifting the mindsets behind what we value in education. So we've got a generation that is used to the reading, writing, arithmetic, the rote memorization, the the sit and get, the teacher at the front of the classroom, the sage on the stage, where we are, looking at kids as widgets on an assembly line, and I worry about that. I really feel like it's starting to change, but really having, whether it be a societal change, but what do we value in education? Do we value the skill of being able to memorize facts and then spit them out in a booklet? Or do we value critical thinking and collaboration and problem solving and communication and social emotional skills, which I think is a huge piece that is lacking often in schools? Is we need kids to be aware of their emotions and to develop self-regulation techniques. We need kids to be able to talk about stress and about anxiety and talk about their feelings. That social emotional learning needs to be more at the forefront of school. So I think that's, for me personally, I feel it's a shift in what we value, and it can't just be the teachers talking about it and the kids jumping board. It's a societal thing. So, parents asking, why aren't booklets coming home for homework? And, why is my son or daughter doing STEM challenges? And, what's this project-based learning going on? I think it's hard because people only know what they know. So if we know school is sitting in desks and filling in booklets and just listening to the teacher as the teacher talks, and us just memorizing stuff, then that's what we know. So how do we shift the mind models for people to understand that kids are more than a GPA, that we need critical thinkers, we need problem solvers, we need people to collaborate, we need kids with strong brain resiliency. And we need to have those conversations of what is it that we value, and what skills do kids need moving forward to be active citizens and to be ready for the job market, which is scary because we don't even necessarily know the types of jobs we're going to have in the future. But I do know, Michael Fullan's 6 C's, like critical thinking and communication and collaboration, creativity, we're always going to need those. But it's hard. It's hard. So I think that's, for me, it's shifting those mind models. And I think really just having those conversations about having people understand that the world we live in has changed. The skills that kids need have changed, and that we need to start thinking about what is it that we value and where are our priorities. If we're together for 6 hours at school, what do you want me doing with your child? Where am I putting my energy? And it's not going to be memorizing stuff for a test.
I've had similar discussions before with teachers and talked about this, the same issue, about this sort of confusing overlap of things we do. And often people will recognize that we need to have this conversation with all stakeholders and not just teachers, but I don't know how often that's actually happening. I think it's easy for a teacher who sits in this world 8 hours a day every day and sees, hey, there's some definite conflicts here. Testing doesn't line up. They see the stress of all those things. But for parents, you know, the kid comes home and says, oh, this was really stressful because of this test I had to take. And the parent just says, I took tests all the time in school. And they don't realize the difference between what we're doing now and what we did then. All they can point to is this common core math doesn't make any sense to them. And that's not the problem, first of all. I just want to point that out. Common core math is not the problem. But how do we, as teachers, as podcasters, as connected educators, as whoever, how does anyone push that conversation with parents in a way that can actually get the conversation moving forward?
I don't know. That's a very good question. And I think at the end of the day, it's making sure that we've involved all stakeholders in our community. I know some schools that have, you know, these Ignite presentations. Have you heard of an Ignite presentation?
I have. I've done one at ISTE last
year. Yeah. Oh, very cool. So, you know, these schools have hosted Ignite evenings where parents from the community are invited to come into the school. And teachers are doing short 5-minute Ignite presentations on different topics, like, you know, maybe project-based learning or inquiry models of learning, or, you know, 21st century soft skills, so to speak. And I think that's a really, you know, intentional effort to talk to parents and guardians about the why are we doing this? Why are things different? Again, because we only know what we know. So we need to get to a place where we can have open, honest conversations, and we can share the why behind what we're doing. You know, I always want parents to question, you know, why is it that my child is doing math that's different than everyone else? You know, I was in a grade 5-6 classroom. I had levels pre-K to 8. So I'm not going to sit at the front of the classroom and teach grade 5-6 math to everyone. If I've got a kid that's working on grade 1-2 math and he's in my 5-6 classroom, well, he's working on grade 1-2 math. If I've got a kid that shows me that they can hit all the learning outcomes in grade 5-6, why can't he start doing some advanced math? You know, and talking about these personalized pathways of learning, you know, no two brains are alike. And I don't think we need a one size fits all cookie cutter approach. So I think, you know, like you said, is how do we shift it to those conversations, and really how do we create that change? And I think it's starting. I think it's through making sure that we are talking to parents, and we're talking to community members, and we're making a concerted effort to share what we know, you know, and for teachers to be able to share their learning. You know, we have lots of teachers who have gone back to school and done postbacks, or, you know, myself just finishing my master's. Like, I want to share with parents what I've learned. I want to talk to them about math class and how I've just read a book, you know, Joe Bowler, Mathematical Mindsets, and now taking away some of the her key findings and what we should be celebrating in math. And if a parent says, oh yeah, you know, my child just isn't good at math, you know, I was never good at math, you know, I don't have a math brain, in me saying, you know, look, I'm going to stop you there. That's, you know, research has shown us that that's actually not a thing, that we, you know, we have that stereotype that there are people who are math brains and there are people who are not math brains. I'm like, that's not a thing. That's not based in research. We are all capable of doing math and sharing what we know, sharing knowledge, and having those conversations, and not keeping them in silos, you know. I think that's super, super important, is to talk about what we know, and for teachers to be empowered to share what they know, share articles they've read, videos they've watched, and do the whys. Like, I wish teachers were able to talk with parents more often. You know, I don't know what you have where you live, but I might see parents, you know, for student-led conferences 3 times a year or 4 times a year. And I wish I was able to talk with parents maybe, you know, even once a month for 10, 15 minutes and just have those conversations about, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, here's some new research that's coming out. And I think through those conversations, parents and guardians start to learn that, you know, school is different. School should be different because the needs, the demands, and what society is expecting is different. So I think it's just really through a transmission of information and sharing.
Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned Ignite evenings, and I immediately texted my AP and I said, "Oh my God, remind me to talk to you about this tonight because I've got to do this. This is happening at my school now."
They're fun.
That's such a great way to do it. I love that idea.
Awesome. Yeah, I know a couple schools that did that, and they had it was like from 4 to 6 after school, and they had a whole bunch of their teachers, you know, signed up for Ignite sessions, and you know, there's one on, you know, math, one in technology integration, one in social studies, and just really talking about, you know, different topics that might be things that we maybe wouldn't have seen 25 years ago. Project-based learning, inquiry learning cycles, you know, purposeful technology integration, Peter Lilidal's, you know, non-permanent vertical spaces and visibly random groups, and, you know, Joe Bowler, 7 norms of the maths classroom. Like, just, you know, this is what it is. This is why it's good practice, and maybe a little bit of the research. And so I would think after an evening like that, parents would leave and go, okay, now I understand why the teachers is, you know, my child came home and said, you know, Mr. B was standing in the front of the classroom and, you know, was doing a lesson, but then all of a sudden next week he changed it and he had defronted the room and he was in the middle of the room and we were all up and we were working on mini whiteboards and we were, you know, we spent half an hour working on one problem, you know, and we kept changing groups and we were doing this gallery walk thing and like we weren't doing any paper or pencil and we were, you know, we were making our thinking visible and a parent might go like, what, why, like, what, you worked on one math word problem for half an hour? Like, no, like you should have done 40 questions in a booklet then. Well, they don't know what they don't know. So let's talk to him about this super smart guy, Peter Lilidal, who's done his PhD in mathematics and has some great research to suggest that, you know, there's different pathways to provide math instruction and we gotta, you know, try something different. And it's not always going to be sitting at the desk and I'm going to teach the exact same thing to everyone and we're all going to do it in the same way.
I love it. Yeah. And I think you're right that we have to build that conversation outside of the classroom. We have to bring that classroom experience from a teacher's perspective who went to school when the parents went to school or around that time and bring that perspective out of the classroom. I think so often teachers are afraid to share that position or afraid to share what goes on inside their walls for fear of judgment or whatever the fear may be. And I think that we desperately need to do that. I can totally agree.
We do. We need to get away from that fear because it's not helping anyone. And we need to have those conversations and, you know, different ways we can do it. You know, they gave what was simulation. So when I left this Ed Elements personalized learning, they gave simulation. So you are like the student and they used, what they call playlists for students to have lots of different options and paths towards what they're going to do, when they're going to do it, how they're going to show their evidence of learning. And I was like a student, I was in the simulation and I thought, what a cool idea, you know, if you could host an evening where there would be different simulations and parents could rotate through, you know, station rotation and they could experience some of these new ways of teaching and learning and, you know, by the act of doing it and learning and they go, okay, I get it. That was fun. That was engaging. I was learning. I really like that. And I think that, you know, there's just being, thinking about what are different ways that we can share what we know with parents and guardians, what are different ways we can have them experience it. And so, you know, they're in a new understanding of school is different and this is why it's different. And I think, unless we do that, unless we make, you know, intentional efforts to create that for parents and guardians, we're a lot of generations are still going to have the understanding that my kids should sit at a desk and they should have a booklet and they need to memorize a ton of information to be able to spit back. And we know that that's not where we want the bulk of the energy. You retest 3 months later and chances are the kids have forgotten most of the facts because they need to make room for the new, you know, binge of information. So it's interesting.
Very cool. I like it. Let's move into question two and talk a little bit about some things you're doing. So what is something you're doing that you wish all teachers would do?
Oh, what is something I'm doing that I wish all teachers would do? That's a good question. I would like to see more teachers reveal their vulnerabilities. Now, what I mean by that is I feel like I'm strongest through the times that I share my vulnerabilities, that I think we do a disservice to the profession when we feel like we have to be the expert on something before we roll it out. I feel like that gets in the way of a lot of really cool learning. A lot of teachers that I work with, don't want to try technology because they haven't learned computer coding. So they don't want to do Scratch because they need to know coding, or they don't want to try something new. It's not safe enough to try because they haven't become the expert, and it becomes very vulnerable if you're going to learn something with your kids in real time at the same time as them. I actually think that's empowering. I actually think when you say, "Hey, I don't know this, let's learn this together," that's very powerful. I think trying new things, leaning into discomfort. Like, I know that's where true growth happens, is when we get out of our comfort zone and we try something new, and we might be a bit scared that it's going to fail. We aren't sure where it's going to take us, but we try it anyways. I think that's very powerful. And just when I, so I'm an expert in nothing, but I am someone who will try new things. I am a learner. I will lean into discomfort to try new things for kids, and getting outside of my comfort zone. So I think being okay with the unknown, sharing those vulnerabilities, not needing to be the expert in everything, I think that also unites us and can help connect us as people. I think the more that we have conversations about things that we're struggling with, things that are hard, things that have been obstacles, roadblocks, challenges, when we have those conversations, I feel like they can help connect us, and we can help talk about those challenging things or things that we're wrestling with and work through them. Because a lot of time when we get into brainstorming sessions or we collaborate, it's talking about all the stuff that's going well. It's a lot of head nodding and agreeing and that's good. And I like that, but I like divergent thinking. I like getting off, the beaten path. I like, challenging. I like getting out of my comfort zone. I like that novelty. One of the reasons why I like this format for a podcast, I didn't know what I was going to talk about. I had no guiding questions. I didn't know the two questions that you were going to ask me. And so I've just come into this conversation, at 5:30 in the morning with a cup of tea, and organically, we're just going to just allow it to happen. And I think that's a beautiful experience. And so I think for teachers, for educators, and for students, I think being vulnerable, being a risk taker, getting out of your comfort zone, trying new things. I think if we could talk about our challenges and if we could do that more, that we would grow more as a profession, and kids would be more comfortable in the uncomfortable. I think school is a place where it should be the most comfortable to be uncomfortable, to have those hard conversations, to talk about things that we're wrestling with. And I think teachers, how often do we ask kids to lean into discomfort, to try something new? But as teachers, how often do we do that? To invite a colleague into our classroom to observe us and to watch us. Well, we wouldn't, we don't want to do that because that would be scary. But how much could we learn by inviting, someone to come in? So, a colleague to, can you observe me? I'd like you to look for the following, things that I'm working on. These are my personalized goals. But we don't do that enough because sometimes it's a bit scary and it's uncomfortable. But if we want to grow, and we want to challenge ourselves, we got to be vulnerable, and we got to be risk takers, and we got to get out of our comfortable little bubble that is safe, but doesn't always lend itself to really deep growth.
Perfect. Yeah, I think I think you wrapped that one up pretty nicely. I don't even really feel like I need to follow that one up. You just boom, beautiful bow. And I agree. I think some of those vulnerable moments are really critical. And like we kind of talked about, that idea of change and fear of change and just general fear of a lot of things holds a lot of teachers back. And I think that's what keeps us from revealing those vulnerabilities is we're worried. We feel like I don't know, maybe it's not as true where you are, but I think teachers often feel like they're under attack all the time. And so they have to be strong and protect themselves at all levels. And that's not necessarily what we need in education.
No, it's not. We have to celebrate the human element. And, you know, it's sometimes, you know, we teachers and educators, we come in, we got to be robots. We got to compartmentalize 24/7. We got to make sure we're 100% regulated. We've got to be, you know, content experts in everything. We've got to, you know, and I think that becomes hard. So I feel like we need to celebrate vulnerabilities. We need to celebrate things that are challenging, have conversations about things that we're struggling with. And I think that's also attached to well-being. You know, this is being a teacher, being an educator, working with kids in any capacity. It's a stressful job. It's a hard job. And I wonder how many educators are are struggling, especially at this time of the year and are in burnout mode. But, you know, just carry on, you know, because that's what you have to do. But I think it's okay to be able to say, you know, I'm struggling. Like I'm having a really hard week. You know what, the lessons that I've planned have completely bombed. And I think we need to have those conversations and take care of each other. Because you know, it's a hard job. We need to be able to support each other and lean on each other. And it's okay to say, you know, you had a bad week and the lessons weren't going well. And, I don't think any less of you. In fact, I see you as a stronger person by you sharing, by you talking and for us to be able to support each other. And for me to say, I hear you, I've had those weeks. What can I do? How can I help? And we need to do that more for each other. People don't have to pretend like everything's going perfect. And I think, that's something we should try to work towards more as a profession.
Yeah. I like it. You know, we're coming up we're just across the 50-minute mark, and we have one question left, but man, this has been a fun chat. So let's roll right into the last one and wrap this thing up with a pretty bow.
Got it.
My third and final question for all my guests is, who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Oh, who is the greatest teacher I've ever had? You know what? I feel like you're going to get different answers. You're going to obviously have, you know, people might say their parents, you know, lean out to. I don't know if I can actually wrap this one up with a perfect bow for you. I don't know if I can give you one specific person, because I'm all about the collective and what I've learned from different people. So I feel if I say my father and what I've learned from him about life in general that has helped me so much, then I'm doing a disservice to what my mom has taught me. And if I share what my mom has taught me in my life that has grounded me as a person, I feel like if I haven't mentioned, you know, a specific grade 5 teacher that I had, I would be putting them all at a disservice. So I think it's different people for different reasons. But if I were to go back to, excuse me, one teacher, I had a teacher in grade 7-8 that I remember. You know, that's sort of an awkward stage of life. You're trying to figure out where you fit in, what group you belong to. You know, you're going through some social, emotional roller coasters with puberty and everything going on. But I think that teacher really stood out for me. Now, not because what she taught me. To be honest with you, I can't even really tell you a whole lot of the specific facts that I memorized or I learned in grade 7-8. But why that teacher stands out is I really felt like I belonged. I really felt cared for. I felt valued. I felt heard. I forget who said it. It might have been Maya Angelou. And yeah, I think I'm taking this, paraphrasing this, but you know, kids aren't going to remember all the facts that they've learned, but they're going to remember, you know, how you made them feel. And I think, that teacher stood out to me because, of how she cared for me and how she how she valued my specific skills, took time to develop a relationship. I remember she came to a couple hockey games and I'm thinking, what's my teacher doing here at my hockey games? And I wonder how she done that for other kids. And then hearing like, oh yeah, she, you know, she came to my buddy's soccer game and she, you know, she had made a real conscious effort to get to know kids, to get to know what they cared about, to get to know their hobbies, to get to know their families. And I think it was through that relationship piece that, that I remember her as being an amazing teacher. My dad used to say, you know, my parents were both educators. My dad, a teacher for many years, had said, kids don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I think that has always stood out in my brain, because I think that's so important. I think that the teachers that really work super hard at developing those relationships, and making sure kids have a sense of belonging and feel cared for, feel valued, you know, their unique strengths and skills celebrated, that reciprocal trust. I think those are the teachers you remember, that you remember the teacher that went out of their way to get to know you. Not just as an academic student that can talk to you about math and about science, but as a person that can talk to you about life and about skateboarding and hockey and things that you cared about when you were 13, and you have a teacher asking you about, you know, why you like skateboarding, what new tricks you're working on, and you know, what you did on the weekend, and how was that camping trip, and you know, how did the game go last night, and you're thinking to myself, oh, they remembered I had a game last night. And I think that's something that, again, what is one thing that I do that I would like to have teachers do more of? And not that they're not doing it, but just relationships are at the heart of it all. And I think that's the most important thing, that we take care of each other as humans, that we take care of our kids. And every once in a while, you take a pause on the academics and you get into the social emotional realm. You know, I think, that's probably for me, you know, and I think, you know, like my parent, that teacher felt like they were like a third parent who looked out for me, who cared for me. And I liked coming to school, probably not necessarily because of the academics we're doing or the amazing, you know, technology or inquiry learning where I got to do my own projects. I think I really liked going to school that year because I really felt cared for. I felt valued and all that, those words that I keep repeating, but that sense of belonging, that doesn't happen through really awesome pedagogy. That happens through relationships. And I think that to me is the most important. We're people first. And I think I value that above all else.
Man, I like it. People first. And that's what we need to remember about our students.
We do.
And our teachers and our fellow, our peers, everything. I like
you
it.
Bet.
I like it a lot. Man, let's close it out there. I think that's a pretty place to end.
Beautiful.
It. We'll wrap that thing up.
Awesome.
I like it. Thaddeus, first of all, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And if my audience would like to get a hold of you, how can they reach out?
You know what? I am on Twitter, Thaddeus B. Teach at Twitter. So THADDEUS, capital B, Teach at Twitter. And, you know, anyone who's interested in learning more about personalized professional learning in the Louis Riel School Division or different initiatives that we have, you know, I love sharing stuff. I've got OneDrive folders filled with tons of resources, with technology integration, with different things that I'm happy to share. So, you know, people can reach out to Thaddeus B. Teach, and I'm willing to share stuff and have those conversations. And thank you for having me on the show, Brad. I was a little you know, leery about getting up at 5 a.m. to do a podcast before I go into the office. But this has been a really nice start to my day, and I very much enjoyed being on your show, and I appreciate the experience, and I thank you for the invite, Brad. It was time well spent.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining me. I appreciate
you
it.
Bet.
Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Take care, Brad.
Thaddeus, thank you so much for a great chat. To connect with Thaddeus, you can find him on Twitter. He's at Thaddeus B. Teach. If you have questions or comments about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram at Brad Treffler. I love to hear from you guys there, and that's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or you can check out the feedback page on my website that gives you additional options for feedback as well, which you can find at bradtreffler.com/feedback. And I look forward to meeting some of you at ISTE on Sunday, June 23rd at 6 p.m. Until next week, what do you value in education? Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.